Welcome to episode 9 of the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education, and Hubble, really?
Really, this time. You know why I put that there?
No.
Anyway, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Kelly. And together, we host the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
So let's get started. So this is being recorded May 7th on Thursday. And it's going to be put out on the 10th. And, oh, I forgot one. So first, administrative stuff. It's not on here, but the big thing we'll talk about more is the blog and the podcast and the full Frontal Harvest website is now a lot easier to get to because you can access it through the IP address of our modem.
Right, right.
So, like, at first I thought it was not too difficult. I mean, for people that know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it turned out it was really difficult. So, anyway, summer's coming, so soon we'll have a hosting service.
We keep on looking into that and then getting distracted. But
it is out there.
Yep.
So you can access it. So for the few people who are able to. The other thing is, so the reason I put Hubble really is because last podcast was a little bit difficult, mm-hmm. and we had to cut it early.
Yeah, because I was sick.
Yeah, and in the beginning, as usual, we'd forgotten to put something to add.
Right.
And you had come up with Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to that point where we were going to talk about it.
We forgot?
No, I don't think we forgot. I think we forgot we'd said Hubble in the beginning, right? And then, like, we have to stop this. And so we said, okay, we're not going to talk about Hubble. So.
Got it. I had forgotten. I thought we had talked about it because part of it was the celebration of
the Hubble. The 25-year celebration. Anyway, I've looked up a bunch of stuff about it.
Neat. Very cool.
And we're still working with our microphone system that I don't know. We
aren't very happy with it.
No, we definitely
have to come up with another.
We were happy for a bit, but this is not going to work very well.
Right.
So maybe by next time.
Mm-hmm.
Go over the blog entries first.
Okay.
So mine or yours?
You first. Mine I went first last time.
Okay. So the one I wrote about is kind of a continuation of an earlier one. I'd mentioned the Oshpark board that we'd gotten for mm-hmm. the AT Mega. And the problems we'd had with that. So we're kind of stressed for time now. And basically this blog entry was where we've moved on from now. And mm-hmm. the Oshpark has kind of been put to the side because we really want to get the ARDF radios going for mostly for the school, and then there's a possibility of something in August
mm-hmm.
In Colorado. But so I was really going for the school, but I guess from your last email, it looks like this is not going to happen this year. This school year.
Right, it's not this school year.
Not enough time.
Yeah, this school year is starting to wind down.
Yeah.
And at this point, the students aren't as invested. They're kind of invested in leaving. In eighth grade and becoming high schoolers. So,
well, that's why I had kind of switched originally, trying to think, oh, maybe there's just time to do one small thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still good.
Mm-hmm. Definitely something we can do in the future.
Yeah. So we have two transmitters that are partially built, but one of them is really close to being ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, except it has no antenna.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started working on that, making sure that it could be, it's for ARDF, you really need a good case and a good system that you can carry in rough conditions, and it's got to be sturdy and easy to assemble.
When you get there, it can't be too bulky because you're running in the woods, exactly. Setting something up quickly, yeah. And moving on so that you can get started on the outing.
And then there's the other requirement. We've got to be able to hear it.
Yeah.
So that's part of the thing. I know I did some measurements on the place we're thinking of going.
Mm-hmm.
which is just by the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like at most we'll need it to be able to be heard from about 5 kilometers away. That's if it's at one extreme end and we're at the other extreme end. And so, but it's really interesting doing the antenna work. And one of the things that I'm not sure about is the whole antenna matching thing. So I'm doing some measurements built a big inductor.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect, well, I don't know, but I'm thinking it might actually make no difference whatsoever. I mean, I'm not sure if it's going to make the antenna any more efficient.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to figure that out.
Yeah.
It's neat to see how you are graphing things and getting the information. So you have to understand, so through the week, we have Patrick doing these little experiments on the things that he's building. And so we have sometimes beepers going off every, 5 minutes?
Oh, okay. I knew this was going to come back to bite me. There hasn't been a single complaint, and I didn't understand. But anyway.
I thought I'd wait for a public forum.
Right. Okay.
So,
moving on to your blog.
Okay. So, moving on to my blog. For the last year, I've been involved with the Keenan Fellows Program, and in fact, this was my Keenan Fellows internship year, and it was an incredible opportunity where I can go and work with a person, and it could be a person in industry or in research. I was able to work with two people that do very different research. One works in an entomology lab in genetics, mm-hmm. and then another one who works in the social science arena of genetics. So it was really a great experience, and it helped me really dig into an area that I needed to learn a lot more about. And I had a passion to learn more about. I just didn't know where to start.
That whole time was really fascinating.
Yeah. And it was scary and challenging. And I think that...
I have to say, one of the things that just rubbed me the wrong way from your blog entry,
mm-hmm.
was the way you were like, oh, this made me so passionate and stuff. But I remember you being really excited before. And that's what got you into it.
Yeah.
And then we both got excited about the actual material when we started to find out.
Right.
But
I had an interest in that field that I applied to. Yeah.
I mean, it's not by chance you ended up doing that biotechnology type stuff.
No, I applied for that particular internship. And you can apply for different internships and choose kind of topic-wise what best fits you and what you teach. And the fun thing is that I, as part of, let me back up. So it's something that I'm continue to be very interested in and passionate about. And I'm trying to build strong units in the area of biotechnology and just really try to figure it out and understand it so I can teach it better, but also get the kids thinking deeply about it, because some of it we just need to think through, and there's a lot of ethical issues that come up.
When we were at the meeting last time, I mean, I desperately wanted to talk about Dr. Gould and his work and stuff, but actually the thing that I'm remembering the most, this is really bad, but when we were at the, it was kind of like the finishing up celebration,
mm-hmm.
And was it, who was it who was there who was from the state legislature or the state senate?
Oh, that was, oh dear. Oh, I know his name and I can see his face. Oh.
Oh my gosh. It's on the public. Everybody's going to know you don't remember.
I know. It is Meyer, Greg Meyer.
Greg Meyer.
Representative Greg Meyer.
I couldn't believe it. You guys were buddies and talking, and you're going up to talk to him, and I'm like, oh, she's just going to say, yes, I'm a school teacher, you know, doing science stuff or whatnot, and No. He's like, hey, Kelly.
Like, what? Well, he's one of the people that have really worked on developing or really just trying to get people to think more of equity issues and within their classroom and within the school. And that's another area that...
I mean, it's not surprising he was there in right. terms of... I mean, I know the speech is tailored to educators mm-hmm. because that's where he is right now.
But
I
that's
mean,
where he came was. From.
But,
yeah.
But well, for, I mean, he's a very good speaker for one oh, thing. Yes. But apart from that, he seemed like education was his number one issue.
Right.
And like you said, equity.
Equity. Mm-hmm.
Anyway. But all through that time, I have to say that my favorite was all that work that Dr. Gould was doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So Dr. Gould's this, he's a senior researcher, a PI, and he has been in his field for a long time, well respected. Just anyone that's had contact with him just has such wonderful things to say. They're like, oh, you're working with Fred. Fred is blah, 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 blah. And they just have all these wonderful things that they could say about him. But what's cool is this man who, you know, when they started to use BT crops, started to think about, wow, you know, if I collect a bunch of insects before BT crops are really implemented, and then after, I can maybe see some changes that have occurred in the pests that feed on BT or on these types of crops, and see how the BT component of the crop has impacted the insect. And it was way before they were really digging into genetics. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool that now he's kind of he has been on the leading edge of looking at selective strategies that insects develop as a result of the BT crop being implemented for so long.
Yeah, we did a lot of literature, mm-hmm. you know, reading and search when you were doing that work.
Yeah.
And it was very complicated and fascinating. And
oh, it was. And I'd have to read it all again just to try to make sense of it before I talk to anyone about it. But, yeah. Neat stuff. And after being at school and I had my media specialist help me with something, and I happened to mention to him that I was really interested in biotechnology and this area, and I wanted to look at really to see what kind of crops that we have that are genetically modified and compare that to the amount that is organically produced and look at, wow, how much feed is produced of each, and do we really have that much organic, you know, beef, or is it something that people are saying, wow, it's organic? And then if you look at like the amount of feed for these animals, it may not be possible.
Yeah.
And there's been no information to really support for, you know, whether this is happening or not, but it's something I want to get into in other areas. And I happened to talk to my media specialist, and he was finishing his master's, and he said, Kelly, you know, I'm interested in biotechnology as well and the crops part. I'd like to take this topic on with you, and I'll provide articles and you can read them, and then maybe we can build up, you know, just our understanding of it. And I want to continue doing this with you. And his point is he wants to help me find the information because he's curious too after talking to me. So it's kind of neat that I will be continuing to do this through the summer as a personal project, but Gabe wants to make sure that he helps out.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
It's a nice little way of making community, and we're both just doing it out of interest. It may be things we use with within our class or within the school, but I really don't know. So fun, very challenging, and definitely worth it. And I think it's pushed us to put together a blog and to start to think of what we want to do as next steps.
Yeah, I'm
which is always.
It's been long enough that I'm starting to forget exactly what the whole genesis of this thing was. I mean, I know you were interested in doing it at our 25th year, and
mm-hmm.
and then we got busy, but we did get started.
We did
last year, and the first mm-hmm. one was ready to go January. So
yeah, it took us 6 months to think about it and figure out what we were wanting to do. So nice and neat to have started something new and have it grow beyond just that initial experience.
Okay. Should we move on?
Mm-hmm.
Topics of interest?
Okay.
So I hope you don't mind. This might be a really long one. There's
okay.
just so much stuff. I definitely don't want to cover everything.
You mean the 2 pages?
No, Kelly, look. Let me see. Let me go to the last one.
Let me save you. He has 5 pages.
5? This is a 9.
I'm teasing.
Anyway, we're definitely not going to cover that. I think if we are going to cover something, maybe we should start with Hubble.
Okay.
Because
we forgot it last week.
Yeah, and I just looked up some stuff. There was a kind of a fun article in the latest Science. I mean, they've had several articles, both Science and Nature, about Hubble and a lot about the James Webb Telescope,
mm-hmm.
Space Telescope, because that's, you know, everybody's looking forward to that in another 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, but do you have stuff that you remembered for? Because you're the one who got excited for that.
Well,
by the way, I'm on page 5. That's where I had my notes in case you want to spy some stuff.
Okay. Oh, got it. Okay. So
the pages are in the upper right corner. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Are you too narrow to see them?
I am. That's okay. It doesn't mean I can't find it.
Oh, that's right. You've got a little page marker.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Yeah. So for Hubble last time, I really just, you know, thought of the anniversary and just all those cool images.
Do you know what? 25 years?
Yeah. Yeah. We're one year older.
We're 1 year ahead of Hubble. Well, maybe I can go over what I found out today.
Yeah.
Because
go ahead.
It's
been
a while now since you looked at it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess one of the things that I found fascinating was the whole history of it and the different stages it went through. You know, of course, there was the initial screw up with the mirror, which.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a pretty big mess up.
Yeah.
And I don't remember why it happened. But it got fixed with the space shuttle mission.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first one. And I don't have it on our notes here, but I remember from another article that what happened was, I think, late 1993, like December, they fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first images got released in 1994, the corrected images. This event that I'm going to mention was not in this article, so I don't know exactly when it happened. Mm-hmm. But you remember Shoemaker-Levy 9, the comet mm-hmm. crashed into Jupiter?
Yeah.
And it was really cool because the one comet became a whole bunch of little pieces because of the differential gravity between mm-hmm. the different parts. I mean, it's like tidal forces, right?
Right.
And I still remember the pictures that came back. I mean, before they came back, just expecting to see those pictures
mm-hmm.
when it crashed into Jupiter. And it was from the Hubble Space Telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I think is one thing that's kind of fun about the history is they got it fixed, and then that comet arrived at Jupiter like within
right on cue.
A month, a couple months maybe, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So just on time.
The pictures are incredible. I have them up now, and
yeah.
it's just, it is amazing. Yeah.
The ones
see.
I remember being most fascinated about are not like the one you have. Yeah, more like that one. Mm-hmm. Like you can see Jupiter and you can see all these dots in a row. Mm-hmm. And they're all from disturbances in the atmosphere where these pieces of the comet hit. And of course, they're hitting sequentially, but the planet's rotating.
Right.
Or the winds are moving the fields around. Anyway. Mm-hmm. And the deep fields. So there mm-hmm. were three different experiments to look very deep into space. The first one, I don't know when it was. I think it was in the 1990s, where mm-hmm. it looked at the same spot for 10 days in a row. And I don't know if, I don't think it was during the entire time, but it was sequentially.
Right.
All through that time, taking many images and then putting them all together. And then finding just an unbelievable number of galaxies that we couldn't yeah. see any other way.
Right. You know. So that was...
And there were two more of those. Mm-hmm. The last one, called the Extreme Deep Field in 2012, galaxies they figure they can see, some of them were from 13.2 billion years ago. Wow. 600 million years after the birth of after the Big Bang, right? And mm-hmm. it's like, I mean, this is incredible. It's mm-hmm. like that we can see that far back. I don't know how much further back you can go without the universe becoming opaque.
Right.
That would have to do with inflation, I suppose. But anyway, what else? Well, I mean, there was tons of stuff that the Space Telescope did. The other thing that I thought was really neat is, so the James Webb Telescope, mm-hmm. which is planned to be launched in 2018, it's going to be more redshifted, its spectrum, to mm-hmm. look through dust and to see, well, it's not just dust, I guess, also for looking into the very distant past. I think it was on Wikipedia, it was saying that, or maybe it was on in AAAS Science, that the stuff from the earliest times in the universe that we can see is so redshifted, like,
yeah,
it needs a telescope that's that for...
Neat.
You know, into the infrared to see the stuff. Let me see. Mirror diameter, 6.5 meters compared to, what's Hubble? 2.4? 2.4 meters?
So huge difference.
Yeah. In 18 sections, 1.3 meters each. That's
have like a different...
It's kind of scary, right? Because hexagon it's going to shape. Be so far, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you be sure it's going to work?
I know, it's interesting.
The cost is so high.
Right.
Anyway.
Estimated cost, $500
million. Oh, no.
And it's probably way
over. No. Even the earliest time, wait, I have the stats. The costs, the estimated cost here somewhere. I didn't write it down, but it was in the billions of dollars from even from even the latest. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're saying just the mirror?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Just the mirror.
Just the mirror.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway. So that's a big, exciting project.
That is. It'll be interesting, and it's funny, I don't think I can get my mind around what they'll be able to image or how those images will change.
So,
you know?
One thing that's really interesting is to think about what's been put up there in terms of the frequency range we mm-hmm. can see.
Yeah. Oh,
someone's at the door.
Okay.
Just leave it. Or
it might be package. Car. Yeah, it might be car too.
Ah, okay.
That's fine. I'll pause this. Sorry. Better.
Okay, we're back.
We're back.
And it was delivery of the new battery for my computer. So, oh, you might want to move over because you're really close to the mic. Oh, that's right.
There we go.
We need to be about even.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can. Okay. Yeah, that's the this battery that died during the makerspace where I was volunteering.
Too small to be your battery.
Too small.
I'm sorry. I don't think it's your battery.
No, yeah, it's not my battery?
No, it's not your battery.
Something you got. Anyway, so back to Hubble and the James Webb Telescope. So one thing that I found really interesting was to kind of list what's out there in terms of the range of frequencies it can see, mm-hmm. the wavelengths, right? So the human eye is like 390 to 750 nanometers, and Hubble is in that range and wider, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the instruments on Hubble, I looked up, went down to 115 nanometers. So that's pretty small. And I mean, that's pretty far into the UV, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then another instrument goes as high as 1700 nanometers. So that seems to me like it's pretty far into the infrared, but I think maybe not that much. And James Webb is going to go 600 nanometers to like 28.5 microns. Yeah. So that seemed to me like it was pretty far. The Spitzer telescope actually goes, that's way further. So people say that's an infrared. And that's 3 microns to 180 microns.
Wow.
So James Webb is not going to go close to that. They must know they don't need to go that far into the infrared to see the stuff. But the big thing, I guess, is, so Spitzer's dead. Mm-hmm. It ran out of helium a while back, and that ended its life. But the mirror on Spitzer was tiny compared to James Webb. And then there's the Herschel telescope, which is even more into the red zone. I don't know if it's actually called something else. At the other end, there's the Chandra X-ray telescope. And I actually couldn't find on the Wikipedia page what's the spectrum. But I did find X-rays are 10 picometers to 10 nanometers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really ultra high energy stuff. So we're really hitting hitting everything. So anyway, that's kind of all I had.
Okay.
From stuff I looked up today.
Okay. I found something interesting today that I thought was really cool. So we've been going over ocean stuff.
Moving to biology.
Moving to biology.
Okay, let me see if I can find stuff. Go ahead.
Okay. And it was deep ocean microbes. They're an archaea bacteria. And they found one they call Loki, or a species that they're calling Loki, that is a nice, it looks like a nice connection between, it's like the most eukaryotic, like, prokaryote that they've had.
How do you spell Loki?
L-O-K-I.
L-O-K-I, okay.
Yeah. So, interesting stuff, especially because, you know, using the deep oceans and the hydrothermal vents to make the connection to early life on Earth. I find that amazing in that research.
Did they mention what it was about Loki that made it more like eukaryotes than other archaea? Like probably protein, probably did some genetics or something.
An actin cytoskeleton and rudimentary internal structures composed of membranes.
I wonder if it's like similar. It sounds, looking over your shoulder here, it looks like they're saying a real actin.
Right. However,
I didn't know that archaea had actin, actually.
No, they usually don't. That's what's kind of unusual about this one. But they also said that, you know, this is really early to make this call, and that more research has to be done to really make that kind of connection. So, but very interesting, and I love the deep sea research that they're doing in around hydrothermal vents. Just cool stuff on archaea bacteria.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So since we're on biology, let me see. What would you like? Well, let's cover just one of these. I have some dissolved organic matter in the ocean, so that's mm-hmm. similar stuff. Mitoribosome stuff. Dam removal, that's not... Well, that's kind of biology. Mm-hmm. And more on the CRISPR-Cas9 paper. Yeah. What would you like to hit?
I'd like to hit the CRISPR-Cas9.
So the paper from the Chinese...
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Did we talk about that last time?
We did.
We did.
A little. Mm-hmm. We mentioned it in passing. So,
I'm going to just try to say this. The team was led... And one of the people in my lab helped me with the pronunciation, but it's been a while. So, but I think it's Junju Huang. Junju Huang is the way I'd pronounce it more English-like. Sun Yat-sen University in Gangzhou. So that's the team leader. And let's see. They took 86 embryos from a clinic, maybe more than one clinic, I don't know, but from at least one clinic where they were doing in vitro fertilization. And they wanted to ensure that these, so maybe we should back up because right. people might be jumping in here and not realize why this is important.
Right.
There's been a brouhaha over the last couple months because people knew, or there were rumors.
There was rumors that this was going on.
That someone had actually used genetic engineering on human embryos. Mm-hmm. And modifying the germline is something that some people find really scary. So they took these 86 embryos, and they chose specifically embryos in which the ova had been fertilized by two sperm, which means that they can't go to term. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's kind of, and in my mind, that's, people are so worried about this, that's really significant to me because
right.
the way I understand it, CRISPR-Cas9 is easier to use compared to other things, but people have done already modifications to genes in reprogrammed stem cells, right? I mean, and that's the way that Dolly the sheep was cloned, right?
Right.
So, or maybe those weren't even stem cells. They were reprogrammed cells of some kind, you know, somatic cells. So, you know, in that sense, that was a lot more dangerous than what they did here. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so moving on. So these were probably at the single cell stage, I think. Mm-hmm. So they were zygotes, but I'm not sure. But 48 hours after they, I don't know the system they used to get CRISPR-Cas9, they probably used a virus, but I'm not sure. Or maybe they injected them, each one individually. Probably mm-hmm. they did that.
Yeah.
But they waited 48 hours, and that got you to the 8 cell stage. And of the 86, 71 survived, and 44 were genetically tested. I bet you there's more to it than that, but that's the information I got. Of those 54, 28 successfully spliced in the CRISPR-Cas9 system, the, mm-hmm. the genes, and 4 of those contained material to repair the cuts in the DNA that they had made. So I think what they were targeting a gene that causes disease in humans when it is mutated. Let me see. I'm on page 7, by the way.
Okay.
And I think it's, I can't remember the name of the disease, but it's a metabolic disease where one of your enzymes is messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is we destroy that gene if it's mutated, and then we insert somewhere new DNA that's the correct sequence for that gene.
Right.
And if you remember a few weeks ago, some group, I think they used CRISPR-Cas9 and somehow got it into the liver of mice.
Right.
And they actually cured the mice of disease with a very low fraction of the cells being successfully transformed into this
right.
new. So this is kind of exciting stuff, even though their success rate was very low.
Right. But from what I understood, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that the system that the researchers used on the embryo was different than the one that was used on the mice. That the mice, they used a slightly different system.
Well, you had mentioned that what the Chinese group had used was out of date. I mean, it wasn't the very latest, right?
Right, it was
so
not the
latest. Don't know if that's how it's different, but I think both of them were the CRISPR-Cas9 system.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know if it can be much more successful if they use a more advanced technique, but it's kind of interesting. Anyway, that's what they did. And I don't know if there were any tests apart from that. One of the things that they found that was really scary and is that there were many off-target mutations, meaning mm-hmm. that the genes got inserted into just random places.
Right. They had a lot of mosaic cells that had some of
right.
the cells that
right.
were right. modified and some were not.
Right. But even if some were modified and some were not, what I was saying is the scary part is there's also some of the genes inserted in just unexpected
right.
places.
Right.
And the reason that's
scary
is that even if the person is cured of the disease, so, okay.
Modifications have you caused and ramifications do they have?
That's known to cause cancer.
Yeah.
Right. And I have to say, we're talking about this in a kind of theoretical way, right?
Right.
No one's talking yet about curing people of diseases
right.
with this. This is just basic research to understand the biology of this early stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people that really think, in general, germline modification is a bad idea, a lot of them also feel like, but research in germline modification is not necessarily a bad idea, right? There's many things that we can find out by doing germline modification in embryos that are not going to be viable, which have nothing to do with curing diseases, about, you know, how to solve fertility problems. And
right, right.
So. Anyway, so yeah, this is the paper that got everybody up in arms about what's happening. And the way I understand it, there's other labs already and have been already working on germline modification in humans, in human embryos. No one, you know, I'm sure is thinking of doing this, you know, and then
unviable.
Allowing, yeah, doing it on viable embryos.
Embryos, yeah.
So, let's see.
Okay.
Done with biology, or do we have more biology?
No, done with biology right now.
What next?
Why don't you go on to the...
We have a lot of work that we've done.
We have.
What about your the makerspace today?
Okay, Makerspace today was our last kind of hoo-ha for the year. It was our last enrichment class. And to kind of finish out with crazy activity, I asked the students if they would like to make bottle rockets. They were all about making bottle rockets today. So we made rockets that are powered by vinegar and baking soda. And
what was the dry ice part?
The dry ice was a student who was there. I was looking over their shoulders. I always look over their shoulders when they're at the computer just to see what sites they're going to and that. And I looked over one kid's shoulder and he's like, I go, what are you looking at? Because it was like this fire extinguisher hooked up to this device. It was totally homebrewed and totally wrong in many ways. And he's like, this guy is making dry ice with a fire extinguisher. And I'm like, what a bad idea. I'm like, I think there's...
All the fire extinguishers in your room.
Exactly. I'm like, but you could just go to a grocery store, you know. But anyway,
That's
not the point. I want to know how they make it. And so he was all about it, and he kept on going from one site to another to see how it was commercially made, to see, and he just couldn't stop. And so this week I thought, okay, I am going to bring in dry ice. This kid just needs to see it. He needs to play with it a bit, and so he can kind of experience it. And his father had a funny story about being burnt with dry ice. And so I was like, okay. So I brought it in and I just broke up a bag and put it in little graduated cylinders with colored water and some soap. So it foamed up and went all over the desk. And the students love it. And then I heated up some water and I dumped a whole bunch in. And it just made this huge cloud of it. It just kept on billowing out all over my desk and all down the desk and that, so the kids could really see it. And they loved it, and they played with it for, it was only meant to be like a 10-minute demo.
Yeah.
It went on for 20 minutes, and I said, okay, enough of that. We need to build. And
so they built rockets?
They built rockets. So they built them out of recycled plastic bottle, four pencils, tape, and a cork. And then they mix up vinegar and baking soda. And the vinegar and baking soda are your fuel. Right. And you wrap the baking soda in a paper towel so it kind of stalls the mixing.
Right.
And you, right before you set it upright, you shake it. Mm-hmm. And then you set it down and it explodes into the air. Cool. And we had one go 30 feet in the air. It was a really good one.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty good. Most of them just popped up like 3, 4, 5 feet.
Uh-huh.
And the kids were like, whoa, which was good too. And then we had dry ice left over, and this one kid.
So do they put fins on them?
No, they could, but.
So the one that went 30 feet in the air, it's just like by chance, it just kept going straight up.
It went straight up. So it depends on the base.
Right.
Okay. And he had a nice solid base on his. And other kids that didn't work to make their base solid, you know,
it went off to the side
or it just didn't get a nice straight lift off.
Right.
And so he did a good job. So that was neat. And, we went through a gallon of vinegar.
1 gallon.
1 gallon.
The EPA is going to be showing up.
I know, exactly. And it was fun, though. The kids were just, they made bottle rockets steady, like, so keep on mixing and changing out the amount of vinegar and the amount of baking soda to get the best blast off and, you know, comparing it with each other. So it was good. It was a lot of fun, and the students really had time to play around and think about it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Let's see. Should we talk about stuff we've done or the building stuff? Talked about the building already a bit. The camera we didn't get to, the Raspberry Pi camera we didn't get to work yet. We found a bunch of stuff. We tested it on the one at home. we found out that the connection socket was a serious problem because we got further
right
than before. But then we tried Raspi still and had some strange error come up.
Right.
You guys didn't go back to that at this makerspace.
We did not. We didn't even touch any electronics today since I had dry ice and vinegar and baking soda out. I didn't.
That's good. That's
I thought if we're going to do something that was that would damage electronics to keep them separate.
Yeah. I'm kind of wondering if... Did Isaac have his own camera or was this Isaac's camera?
No, it was a Raspberry Pi camera and we gave it to him. No, he stole ours, actually. We didn't give it to him.
I mean, I'm starting, because some of the stuff on the web was mentioning possibly hardware failure with this error. And I don't know. Other people are saying, no, this is this other thing. But, you know, if we had another one to test, we would know it's not a software issue. Mm-hmm. As long as the two cameras are exactly the same model and...
I'm getting my new Raspberry Pi soon, so it won't be a problem.
Because Isaac's coming up. So we have a road trip coming up, but maybe we'll...
No, I meant the Raspberry Pi 2.
The whole Raspberry Pi 2, yes.
I'm not getting an old Raspberry Pi. You can have the old one. I want the new one.
Gotcha. With a camera.
With a camera.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. For the building, we talked a bit about the fact that we're building the next radio. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll move on from that.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be more to talk about when we get the antenna up and stuff. But I did. So one of the things that was... if you want to
know. No, I was looking.
We're at like 48 or so.
Good.
Well, actually, we started late. I mean, you know, there's the silence before. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I started to do to test out the strength of the signal is I took one of our really good receivers, a German ARDF receiver for 80 meters, and the place where you plug in your earphones, I plugged a phono cable into that with the other one, the other end plugging into the phono speaker for the laptop. And then I turned on Audacity and I had it record directly. So there's no ambient sound added or anything.
Oh, wow.
And you don't remember this because I was working right here on the desk and moving the stuff.
Oh, like, neat.
You must have been busy because I know you were right there when I did this. And I thought I'd showed you the graphs. I showed you a lot of graphs. But basically, when I had it in Audacity, I adjusted the gain on the receiver so that in Audacity, it gave me something that wasn't full force, so that as I got the receiver closer to the transmitter, which was just transmitted into a dummy load, right? I'm just doing this very close. Then I could see what happened to the frequency and the amplitude. Audacity, you can choose the selection and get a frequency spectrum. And so it does a Fourier analysis, I guess. And then you can get from that your dominant frequency. And it has some kind of a power rating in decibels, probably compared to what's the maximum signal it could take in. So, but it's all relative, right? I mean, I don't really care what the maximum is exactly because I don't have a way to calibrate it yet.
Right.
And it also depends on the gain on the receiver. So it's all got to be relative. But that was really interesting. You could see the frequency change also, not just the strength of the signal. And so we're going to be able to do some really good measurements with the antenna.
Nice. Nice.
So, yep. That's all the... That was a really neat new technique, measuring right out of the receiver.
Nice.
It was kind of super fast and simple and got lots of good data out of it.
Oh, that's super.
Let's see, what else?
I thought there was something about Ubuntu.
Well, no, Debian.
Debian.
April 25th. This is really funny. So there it is, right there. Yep. Debian 8, Jesse, just got released on mm-hmm. April 25th. And as you know, I was really excited for it.
Yeah.
But the funny thing, in the podcast, I think I've mentioned a couple times, I wrote a script that uses wget to get a copy of a web page where they post what's the latest count of release critical bugs for, mm-hmm. you know, all of them for Debian altogether, the ones for the current stable version and the next release.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it look up the line that I knew, and I found out some stuff that would make it only find a particular line
mm-hmm.
where it said what it was, how many release critical bugs there were for the next release. And then the script would get the number and email me a message saying,
yeah.
this is so many bugs there were, you know, this morning. And
yeah.
And it was going down and down and then up a bit and then down and then, and it was getting really far down. I got really excited. And then suddenly the number of bugs started to go up, and it was just so upsetting because it's mm-hmm. like they've worked so hard to get it down to just like 50 or 60 bugs.
Right.
And then it's going up over 100 and oh mm-hmm. no. And then I realized, well, I found out that Debian had already been released, Debian 8.
Got
and
it.
I'm like, what's happening? How so is this possible?
Yeah.
And it's that the day it got released, the next release became stable.
Right.
And then instantly that line was telling me what was going to be in mm-hmm. the you know, what's now the one that's being put together for the release even after that. Mm-hmm. And of course the bugs are going through the roof because people
right.
are adding all these things that they couldn't add to Debian 8 because it were too advanced and too many bugs.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really funny.
And yeah, because you used to give me the report in the morning when I was having my coffee.
Every morning we have our coffee
it's
together.
It's below 100!
Yeah. And we go over we go over the weather. For bicycling and for mm-hmm. you being outside with the kids.
Yeah. Well, that's something. You've been commuting regularly now since the temperatures have changed.
Yeah. And just this week, the temperature has gone up. And for the first time, I've had to check the Air Now website for our zip code to see mm-hmm. It hasn't been too bad. It's been yellow, mostly particulates rather than ozone. If you look at they have this neat map where you can see the archives of the mm-hmm. whole by month, all these little maps, and you can see the entire United States. And there is some orange here and there,
mm-hmm.
in little dots. It's hard to see, but if you look, you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a few dark red spots that last for a while, and I'm pretty sure those must be forest fires.
Yeah.
There was one out in California.
So, speaking of being outside,
yep.
we can talk about our trail day at Moore's Wall.
I know. That was really neat. So, that was May 3rd, is that right? Saturday?
Yeah. Saturday, May 3rd. And we drove up to Moore's Wall to... Yep.
Which is part of Hanging Rock State Park.
Right. And it's a back trail that climbers use.
Yep.
But it's not one that's... used by people who camp on the other side.
Right. Well, you don't go through the normal park entrance.
No.
Most people don't end up back there.
Right.
Yeah.
So, very nice. 25 people showed up.
Yep.
And everybody worked hard and steady.
And it was put on by the Carolina Climbers Coalition.
Yep. And
I noticed some flyers for the Access Fund. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, but they must have brought them in, or I don't know how much. I know Carolina Climbers Coalition has gotten help from the Access Fund
for purchasing
between pilot. Oh, wait a second. No, you're right. It's for purchasing a place
yeah.
up north.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's in Virginia, actually.
Yeah. Anyway. So that was kind of neat to see.
It was. Colors. It was. Well, and it was nice to meet a group of people that like climbing. Some of them, it's so funny, some people haven't been climbing for a long time.
I know, and they're still helping out, doing things. And.
But they feel very strongly about maintaining the trails. I thought that was so cool. And we climb, but we really haven't been climbing for a few years. And then we met another couple there who recently moved to the area, and this is the way they're getting to know people who like to climb. And so I thought that was neat. That's the way they're running into.
So this is kind of a, this is a blog about tech type stuff, actually. So
tech stuff,
so yeah, we learned some new terminology.
Yes.
We now know what a McLeod is.
Yes.
And what a Matic is.
Yeah. And, and they will leave blisters on your hand like any other hoe or shovel.
Yeah. Yeah. So the McLeod was, it's like a big, gigantic, well, not wide, but thick, thick toothed rake.
Oh, yeah.
On one side.
It looked like a rake that no one could destroy.
But the metal was not, it wasn't really thick metal like you have in a pick or a hoe.
No.
I felt like if I really, like over my head, slammed it against rock, you know, it would bend.
Right.
While a mattock, which is like a pick and a hoe or an axe and a hoe, depending on the type.
Yeah, but a little
that
more.
Was thick
it
metal.
It was thick, like a hammer.
Yeah.
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 It was not like something that you couldn't hammer things with. And yeah. So, yeah. So.
And the organic material.
So.
I didn't realize how much work it is to make one of these trails.
So we were digging and digging and digging. And I think in some places there is a foot of just organic root that needs to be removed from the ground. And it's like this huge knotted mat. So once you loosen part of it, you could lift it off like a rug. Yeah. And sometimes it was easier just to dig down and use your hands. And sometimes it was easier to use the McLeod and try to get it.
Yeah. I think the McLeod worked really well for pulling it up. And the Matic worked well for cutting.
Right.
To start it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think, wow, you see someone working and it's like, wow, that whole chunk of organic matter is above the dirt.
Right.
And it just comes and lifts and rolls back. But you go to do it.
Oh, my
goodness. That thing is stuck down and heavy.
And you're finding roots and rocks, and it's connected and matted with. And
it's amazing. I remember distinctly being in the Amazon and just having, like, you walk through an area sometimes, it's just dirt.
Yeah.
There's just nothing there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And definitely, you know, we've gone off trail in that area doing some reconnoitering type, just fun hikes.
Yeah.
We were following altitude, actually.
Yeah.
And you have no idea how much organic material you're walking on when you're doing that. It feels like just dirt just underneath your feet, but you're at least, like you said, a foot above the ground, the plain dirt.
Yeah.
On this thick, dense organic matter.
Yeah. So, we spent, 6 hours just pulling up the matted roots?
Yep.
And moving rock. But it was fun and a great community.
And it really felt good to help out, right?
Yeah, it did.
Like giving back.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Especially when you start to really love and appreciate an area and it's one that you go back to often. It's important to really show how you value it by helping out.
I remember in Michigan, us doing the mountain bike racing and them having a lot of trail days to help out and stuff. And we never did any of that.
No.
And this year, we went climbing once at Pilot Mountain.
Yeah, we haven't been out that often.
No, because we're so busy with orienteering and in the makerspace at school and stuff. But... I was starting to think, why is it, you know, we're so excited for the climbing. Why is it that we went out this time?
Mm-hmm.
And you know what I think it might be?
Our kids are
moving. Yes! Yes! The kids aren't in the house.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, it's suddenly you can, you know, you have time to think. You don't have every single minute taken up, and you can give back to the community.
Yeah, it's true.
I have to say, if there's parents out there that feel like, I'm going to pause this.
Okay.
So we can stop that. Okay. Okay, so we're back. So I was just thinking, if there are parents out there that feel bad that they're taking their kids to sports and stuff, and there's places that need work, and there's these people that are volunteering and helping out, hey, just take it easy.
Yeah.
You've got your kids to handle.
Enjoy your family.
Enjoy your family.
Because most of the people volunteering were either at our end, their kids were...
Or they're younger.
Or they were younger without kids.
Without kids,
and yeah. That was evident when we were out there. But that's...
One guy was there with his son.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
Yeah, and they were, you know, when you say he was there was his son was in his 20s.
Yeah, they were older.
Yeah, but that was wonderful to see.
That was neat.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see. Not much else for that. Did some work on GNU plot. Not much to say there. It was interesting. Stuff. I got a bunch of things I started work on from Linux Voice.
Mm-hmm.
Great bunch of guys that put on that magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Started working on Git.
Yep.
For the first time, actually not just learning it, but actually using it for something useful. It's mostly I found that I do so much reading, and I take it home and to work and home and to work back and forth. But every time I make a copy, because it goes on the USB stick.
Right.
I really should get the computer connection to work going, so I can look up work articles when I need to.
Right.
But, that's learning how to set up the virtual private network.
Mm-hmm.
I set up, this is kind of really weird, but I set up Git on the USB stick and on the computer at work and at home. And now I have the usual work that I do. And so I guess it's hard to understand. The reason I have to copy everything is because I take notes right on the PDFs.
Right.
Using Zernal. Mm-hmm. And so if I make a copy of everything that I changed and bring it here and make another copy to bring it to work, it just makes copies over and over,
mm-hmm.
which I get rid of old ones, but, you know, it accumulates faster than it did before. So with Git, I have a repository on the laptop at home. I have one at work, and I have one on the USB stick. And I push the changes to the USB stick.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I get to work, I pull them off and I do some work there. And then I push them to the USB stick and take it home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cut down on how fast I'm using up disk space. So that's kind of cool.
Neat.
There's still a lot to learn there.
Mm-hmm.
It might be the simplest system out there for good revision control and collaboration, but it might be really simple to use once you're used to it. But I mean, right now I'm finding it very simple to use, but I can see how something might go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like I try to push some changes I make, and for some reason it doesn't go through. Man, that's going to be a pain. You know, I won't know how to deal with it until I've fooled around with it a bit more. Isaac uses Git.
Mm-hmm.
He's even put stuff on GitHub, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
I can talk to him about it. What else do I have? We had Hubble. Do you have anything else?
No, I don't think I do. I think that covers most of my stuff.
You asked about the Ubuntu phone last time. I didn't have much to say. I looked it up again. I don't know. It looks interesting. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see. Since I don't have a really high-end phone right now,
right,
I don't have something to compare it to. Like, they have the stats for, you know, when it, oh, one thing that it does. So this is from the Linux Voice article. Mm-hmm. One thing that was really cool, I thought, was that it has two slots for SIM cards.
Yeah, I remember you saying that. So you and, could.
Yeah. So that's really neat. I guess the way you'd, let me see, how would, you'd have a plan mm-hmm. on one, and then when you go to some other country, you'd buy a pay-as-you-go mm-hmm. one that you flip in there.
Right.
So that you don't pay your roaming charges. So yeah. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, that is.
They did say that the battery gave them about 24 hours of operation, which means that you have to charge it every day, which
yeah.
is that's for one of these smartphones, that's pretty normal, isn't it? That you need to keep charging it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like mine, yeah. I don't need to. Well, I shut it down all the time. Yeah. So I don't know.
I know. We don't use the phones regularly enough to compare that to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. GNU plot I just mentioned. I think I'll leave it. How are we doing for time? Huh? This was not, I thought it was going to be a lot longer. So, GNU plot is kind of cool because when you make your graph, mm-hmm. like you would in a spreadsheet, instead you do it by commands, but you can save it into a script.
Okay.
And it's really cool. You type in the commands as you go, and you update the graph, and you see the changes happen. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't saved anything, right, and you like the graph you made, there's a command to just save everything you've done to a file, and it creates a file that you can just rerun, and it'll just remake your graph from the data.
Oh, nice.
Which is really cool, yeah. So I definitely want to look at that some more. See, there's a new Audacity version that's mm-hmm. coming out. So we'll have to see about that. Let me see. It's 2.1. I don't know what version we're using right now to record this. One of the things is supposedly their system for noise removal mm-hmm. is better. Although, you know, I think it's the microphone setup that'll really make a difference. Mm-hmm. No, there's only so much you can do with software.
Right.
The quality. I wanted to talk to you. There was a Linux Voice article about Raspberry Pi robots
being tested.
Yeah. And you remember a while back, Pi Wars?
Yeah.
In England and stuff. They mm-hmm. had a whole column about that. So that's
cool.
We'll have to talk about that mm-hmm. some other time. Let me see. I'll put a big red cross on it that we didn't talk about it, but it'll remind me that I wanted to
come back to okay. it.
Yeah, I remember when I read it, I'm like, oh, Kelly is gonna love this for her makerspace, but mm-hmm. you know, we must have been busy with something else. Your Symbionts article.
Yeah.
Where was that? Was out of
that was out science. Of science. Yeah, and so it was just looking at the evolution of symbionts. And symbiosis.
Yeah. And we both weren't super impressed with it.
No, we weren't. That's why I didn't mention much about it.
No.
Yeah.
But it was kind of interesting, the part that there's a lot of symbiotic relationships that look like they're going down an evolutionary path that will never lead to complete integration.
Right.
Right? Like, when is it? The rhizomes, is it called, on the plants?
Oh, yeah.
With the nitrogen-fixing bacteria in the legumes. Mm-hmm. So, if I remember correctly, I think they get their bacteria from the soil new every time you get a new plant, mm-hmm. right? So, with mitochondria and chloroplasts, they're part of eukaryotic organisms, and they're really basically one organism.
Right.
Well, there's some flatworms that they mentioned that get their symbionts passed down from parent to child.
Oh, wow.
And so they're thinking they're going on that way mm-hmm. to being one organism, right? because all of those symbionts are genetically very similar to each other, right? But ones that are acquired from the environment are going to be much more different from each other. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway. Yeah, we weren't super impressed with the article, but there were a few interesting things
there. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't think I have anything else. Does that mean I'm going to have to find this much stuff every time?
Maybe.
Holy smokes.
I can't believe what we covered.
We did go a little bit. I mean, I don't know. There's the beginning stuff, so this is going to be a long one, but it's not going to be super long.
Yeah.
Maybe like 60 minutes or so.
Well, what are your future plans?
Future plans. Well, we have non-science techie or anything. We have a road trip coming up to Fort Benning.
Very exciting.
For seeing Isaac finishing up there.
Yeah.
So he's not going back to Fort Benning after.
Yes, he is. He has ranger school there
after that's right. Before going to, training. How could I forget?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's not really techie, but it's going to be taking up a bit of time, a couple of days. I am definitely going to do some more measurements on the antenna. I'm going to set up a super short antenna. The solenoid I built to test out the antenna, I put taps all along the side. So, and I've already tested the inductance of that thing, hooking up, and the resistance, hooking up to all the different taps. So the next thing is to hook up an actual very small antenna and just use that same system with the receiver and Audacity listening in. And seeing how changing the inductance on that coil changes how much it sends out. And then taking it outside and trying different lengths and seeing, can we get something small enough and sturdy enough built that we can take it out in the woods for actual playing around with the kids and have it be practical and solid, and yet that you can hear it
far enough away. Right.
Because the thing is, we're doing these experiments with the German receivers, but we have a bunch of receivers that are not quite as good.
Right. We want to be able to hear it with all.
We'll have to hear it with all because we're going to run short of receivers with the kids, no matter how. I mean, well, how many receivers do we have? Two good German ones. Two Chinese PJ80s that are built. They're not quite as good.
Mm-hmm. One that one still needs to be built.
Needs to be built. So that will give us five. And then the homebrew one I made, which doesn't have an directional antenna, but can still be used. Like it has a regular, it's one of those rod antennas with the loops wrapped around the rod. Mm-hmm. Like all of ours, actually. We don't have any big loop antennas without rod. So we have five. The thing is, you know, when we did the orienteering with the school, we could send them out in groups and it was a lot of fun for them. I don't think that's going to work with ARDF.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't done it enough and I haven't done it with kids.
Get a bunch of Ys.
Yeah.
Have two kids with their phones on the same
receiver. I know. Well, that's why I was thinking I might have to do that just so that you can get...
Because it's so much better if you can have the kids go in teams.
Yeah. It makes a big difference. Yeah. And the Ys aren't that expensive.
Yeah.
You can get them pretty
cheap. But we're going to have some... And if we do that, we're going to have some things ripped out of earphones and...
Yeah. We're going to have to...
Because they're going to be running around through the bushes and stuff. Yeah. Like, even if we set it up, so there's no reason to.
Yeah.
Right? You know, considering what it was like when we did the orienteering.
Yeah. It'll look like the three-legged race.
Oh, man.
Anyway. So that'll be fun for future plans. And
you have the end of school coming up.
I have the end of school coming up and cataract surgery. So I want to check that and see what that entails. And in fact, I was going to be reading up on it this week.
Oh, I'll have to look up some stuff.
That just
that'll be curiosity. Fun stuff to talk about on the next podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would make some good blog entries, too.
Yeah. So, So and, that's all.
Well, no, there's also... So you're thinking of starting at the end of school. I mean, it's still a ways away, but of doing that research you were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And depending on my eyesight and how much I can read during that time will kind of depend on the speed of my research.
Well, but the research is for later in the summer more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay. I think that finishes everything up.
Yes.
For future plans. Mm-hmm. Okay, so thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvest podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.